Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, March 5th, 2025, we're delighted to host a Courthouse Steps oral argument program on Smith & Wesson Brands Incorporated versus Estados Unidos Mexicanos, which was argued yesterday before the Supreme Court. My name is Kayla Kleist, and I'm an Associate Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's program, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. Now, in the interest of time, I will keep my introduction of our guest today brief, certainly more brief than his career would deserve. So if you're interested, I highly recommend you check out his impressive full bio at fedsoc.org. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Brian Barnes, who is a partner at Cooper & Kirk PLLC. Mr. Barnes joined Cooper & Kirk in 2011, and while he has been there, he's litigated high-stakes cases at all levels of federal court system and has also argued numerous cases in state trial and appellate courts. His areas of expertise include the First Amendment and Section 230, administrative law, election law, racketeer-influenced and corrupt organizations as RICO cases, and gun rights issues. And I will leave it there. Last note before I get off your screens and we head into a time of opening remarks. If you have any questions, please do submit those via the question and answer feature, as we will have an extended portion of today's webinar dedicated to answering those. With that, thank you all for joining us today. Mr. Barnes, the floor is yours.
Well, good morning, everyone, and thanks to the Federalist Society for the opportunity to do this. I thought what I'd do is start off by just laying the groundwork for the case that was argued yesterday, sort of describe the procedural posture of the case and the legal issues that are in front of the court, and then also to provide a little bit of a historical background on more generally how we got here in terms of broadly the types of lawsuits like this one that are now being brought against the firearms industry. So let me start by just sort of describing the case at hand. So this is a lawsuit that was brought in the Federal District Court for Massachusetts by the government of Mexico against a significant number of firearms manufacturers and one wholesaler. And basically the theory of liability in the case on the part of the government of Mexico is to say that the defendants manufacture firearms. They in turn sell them to wholesalers and distributors who then sell them along to dealers, and some small subset of the dealers that acquire these manufactured firearms then engage in various types of activity that violate federal gun laws, including straw purchases, where they sell some of these guns to straw purchasers who then in turn hand them over to drug cartels, Mexican drug cartels that sneak them across the U.S.-Mexican border, where various types of violent criminal activity are perpetrated in the nation of Mexico using these firearms. And the theory of liability based on this fact pattern is that the firearms manufacturers have aiding and abetting liability for the various violations of federal law by the gun dealers, that essentially the manufacturers are legally responsible. They have some form of vicarious liability for knowing that some subset of their products are being basically misused in this way and not taking more steps to intervene to ensure that their products don't fall into the hands of violent criminals in Mexico. And this is a case that for understandable reasons, the defendants raised a defense under this federal statute, the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act, basically saying this theory of liability does not work, really for two reasons. One, because we haven't done enough on the facts alleged in the complaint to really have aiding and abetting liability at all. You know, we're not we haven't joined with these drug cartels or even the gun dealers that are facilitating crimes by these drug cartels. And so we don't have aiding and abetting liability as a sort of a background principle of federal law. But then in addition to that, the complaint alleges this long chain of events between what we did as the manufacturers and just making and selling guns and the actual injuries that have supposedly been inflicted on the Mexican government. And so that's just too many steps in the causal chain to satisfy proximate causation under this PLCAA statute that requires some showing approximate causation for a company that's in the business of selling firearms to be held liable. The district court agreed with these defenses and dismissed the case. The government of Mexico appealed up to the First Circuit, and in an opinion that I would say was really quite surprising on the part of the First Circuit, that court held that, in fact, Mexico had alleged viable claims under federal and state law and that the case should go forward. Smith and Wesson and the other firearms manufacturers then petitioned for cert. The Supreme Court granted cert, and we now have a case that was just argued yesterday with essentially two issues that the court agreed to take up. One is this question of aiding and abetting liability is kind of merely selling products into a market where you know with some degree of confidence that some subset of your products are going to be criminally misused. Is that enough to give rise to aiding and abetting liability? And then second, is this sort of chain of causal events that's alleged in the complaint enough to satisfy the federal standard for proximate causation in this context under the PLCAA? And I think it's worth sort of stepping back as we think about these two questions and trying to situate this case in the broader context of litigation against the firearms industry and the history of that litigation and sort of how we got here. So if one goes back to the early aughts in the late 1990s, there were a number of enterprising plaintiffs' lawyers representing, in some instances, victims of gun violence, in some instances, local governments that, you know, sort of similar to the Mexican government were saying that we have in this case, you know, saying, hey, we incur all these expenses as a result of people getting shot in our jurisdiction. And they brought these lawsuits against the firearms industry, basically on a very similar theory to the one that the Mexican government is pressing here. Congress took a look at those lawsuits. It recognized that, you know, most of them did not meet with success, but there were a handful that got over motions to dismiss, where state courts said, yes, this is enough to trigger liability on the part of firearms manufacturers. And so Congress was troubled by the prospect of sort of lawfare against the firearms industry, potentially undermining important Second Amendment rights. And so it passed this statute, the PLCAA. And what the PLCAA says is you can't bring a lawsuit like this unless you show, number one, that the defendant violated a specific statute that regulates the gun industry. And number two, you've got to show proximate cause under the under a federal statute. So Congress comes in and it essentially federalizes the requirement for a showing of of proximate causation in order for a case like this to go forward. After Congress passed that law, this became a relatively quiet field of litigation for many years. So the lawsuits that had survived motions to dismiss, once Congress passed the law, all of them were dismissed. And this was really an area of litigation where there wasn't a lot going on for a number of years. Fast forward to 2019, and a group of plaintiffs in connection with the Sandy Hook shooting brought a lawsuit basically a lawsuit against Remington that said the way Remington had marketed its firearms, they alleged, had inspired the shooter in that mass shooting to commit his crimes. And that was a violation of the state's consumer protection statutes that govern how products are marketed to consumers in Connecticut. And therefore, Remington and others in the gun industry could be held liable under, you know, consistent with the PLCAA for the shooting. By a vote of 4-3, the Connecticut Supreme Court held that this was a viable sort of theory of liability. The Remington folks sought cert and it was denied. And ultimately the case settled out, but settled on terms that were very favorable to the plaintiffs. And so that case was the firing really of the starting pistol for a new wave of litigation that we're seeing against the gun industry today. And this case brought by the government of Mexico, I would say, is of a piece of that broader kind of avalanche of cases that we see against the firearms industry more generally across the federal courts. And so at least I think part of the reason that the court agreed to take up this case and part of the reason for the court's interest in it is that this case, the Mexico case, is really one of a broader class of lawsuits that we see against the gun industry. And it's a very potentially a very important class of lawsuits because obviously for people to effectively exercise their Second Amendment rights, they need to be able to purchase firearms. And you know, folks that are opponents of gun rights, I would say, have astutely recognized that if they can go after the firearms industry, that is a way of sort of de facto curbing gun rights. So let me, maybe I'll hit the pause button there. You know, obviously a lot to talk about in terms of the way yesterday went, but hopefully that's a helpful background to kind of situate the case and why it's important.
Sounds good. Thank you so much for that summary of the background and sort of how we got to where we are. We already have questions going in, so I'll sort of get into those next as a brief reminder to the audience. If you do have questions, that can go in the Q&A feature as we're getting to those now. We have a questioner who's immediately thinking about oral argument, some of the questions raised, and asks what you make of Mexico's argument that certain guns are being designed with these particular consumers in mind and how that affects the aiding and abetting / proximate cause conversation.
Yeah, that was an interesting issue that came up during the argument. And I thought that Noel Francisco, the former Solicitor General who's representing the defendants in the case, had a very effective response, which was to say really the design features that these guys are pointing to, you know, they fall into one of two categories. Either they're design features that make the firearm, you know, just generally more useful and effective for all consumers, or they're design features, you know, things like having a word in Spanish written on the gun, something like that, that, you know, it's I would say problematic and, you know, potentially racist to say like, oh, you know, you've marketed your firearm to people who speak Spanish, and you know, therefore, this is some kind of effort to encourage cartels to buy the gun. I mean, this is sort of a, you know, there are lots and lots of Spanish-speaking American citizens who are gun owners in this country, and you know, the idea that is somehow a hook for establishing liability, I think, is extremely problematic.
Got it. Next question relates to the nature of the respondents in this case being a foreign government. How did that affect, how does that affect the case? And how was that discussed in oral argument?
You know, one of the aspects of the oral argument that I think is really worth highlighting, maybe the most interesting aspect of the whole thing, was a series of questions asked by Justice Jackson, where she said, you know, part of the reason Congress passed this law is to basically shut down efforts by, you know, plaintiffs of all sorts to try to impose kind of de facto gun control policies on the country through the courts. And that is to a T what we have here. And, you know, the fact that we're dealing with a plaintiff here that's the government of a foreign country, you know, really, I think helps to further underscore the point, and it may in part be part of the reason that the Supreme Court granted cert here, is the idea that a foreign government could come into American courts and, you know, get a federal judge to, you know, if the remedies that they're asking for are granted, they're going to effectively get a federal judge to impose gun control policies on the United States. I mean, this is really quite a troubling idea. And, you know, one that I think ultimately the Supreme Court one way or another is not going to permit. Another kind of way in which the fact that we're dealing with a foreign government as a plaintiff, as opposed to, say, a private plaintiff that was, you know, the victim of some shooting. Another way in which that's potentially important to the case is it does help sort of further attenuate the causal chain that we're talking about here, right, for purposes of the proximate causation analysis. So it's not even somebody who was actually shot by, you know, a member of the cartel who's saying, like, well, you sold your thing and then they sold it to somebody else, and then they sold it to somebody else, and then I got shot and it's your fault. It's like, the government of Mexico has incurred various types of expenses, you know, associated with treating people who are the direct victims of gun violence, and it wants to be compensated, you know, and that's a way in which, on the proximate causation side of this case, there was some discussion of, the RICO proximate causation precedents. And, you know, one of the features that, you know, was interesting, that it was the Respondents Council that highlighted this, but one of the features of a lot of those RICO proximate causation cases is they're cases that were brought by maybe not the most direct victim of whatever misconduct is being alleged against the defendant. And well, that describes this case too. You know, the government of Mexico is not the most direct victim of, whatever illegal acts were supposedly perpetrated by the defendants. And so, I do think it's a feature of the case that's important in a lot of ways, and may well be part of what got the Supreme Court's attention in this one.
Got it. Following up on the point on Justice Jackson's conversation, actually, there were two interesting lines of argumentation that came up in oral argument from her that I'd love to pose questions on. The first you've highlighted, which is this might not be the role of the courts, and Congress may have specifically taken the courts out of giving remedies in this particular context. How does that line of argumentation sort of affect the broader conversation on the role of the courts and congressional intent, or is this a very unique case given the fact it deals with these manufacturers, has an international government, et cetera?
Yeah, it's a good question. And, you know, one thing I could, you know, I think is very plausible that we could see coming out of this opinion is something that does say, you know, this is an important kind of background, you know, underlying purpose of the statute that needs to be kept in mind more generally when courts are interpreting the PLCAA, the point being, okay, to the extent that what the plaintiff is really trying to do is in a sneaky backdoor way, impose a whole new sort of gun control regime on the country that the legislatures haven't adopted, you know, that's a really compelling reason to conclude that there's a problem with the plaintiff's legal theory in the case. And so, you know, if you're cheering for the firearms industry in this case, that would be one thing one might hope to see in an opinion. And it's interesting, you know, obviously Justice Jackson was appointed by a Democratic president, and it's interesting to see her making those points in particular.
Thank you. Also, from Justice Jackson's argumentation, and I think she raised this for both the plaintiffs and the respondents, was the idea that there needed to be an interpretation of aiding and abetting that was particular to this statute versus just a common law understanding. Are there particular facets of the PLCAA that would make it different from other aiding and abetting statutes? How does that sort of part of the conversation affect the broader argumentation in this case?
Yeah, and to be clear, as I understand it, at least the government of Mexico in this case, it's pressing an aiding and abetting theory, basically under the general federal criminal aiding and abetting statute. I frankly was a little bit puzzled by that line of questioning from Justice Jackson. I don't see anything in that statute that makes it meaningfully different from other contexts where courts, including the Supreme Court, have had occasion to talk about what the standard is for aiding and abetting liability. This is a sort of notoriously amorphous area of the law. The courts have not been able to draw clean lines, but the basic question is, you know, you're trying to distinguish between a situation where on the one hand, somebody just sells a product and then the buyer turns around and uses the product to commit a crime versus on the other, a scenario where someone sort of actively facilitates, joins with, the buyer in, you know, helping them commit the crime, right? And it's a messy line. And, you know, frankly, based on the way the oral argument went, I think it's pretty likely that a solid majority of the court is going to say what Mexico alleged in this case is not enough for purposes of establishing aiding and abetting liability. But, time will tell.
Fair enough. Speaking of sort of amorphous principles, there's also a fair amount of conversation on proximate cause and whether or not we had a clear definition of what that was and what that required. I think the answer was no, that there were potentially several trains of precedent and or thought. Can you give a little more context to the conversation on that in oral argument and potentially sort of what proximate cause has been understood to be up to this point?
Yeah. So, you know, the first thing I'd say about this is it's really important and frankly, a lot more important than what the court might or might not say on aiding and abetting liability. And the reason it's so important is it goes back to kind of the broader sweep of lawsuits that the firearms industry is facing today. So the thing that unifies these cases is that in virtually all of them, there's a plausible proximate causation defense that the gun industry can raise under the PLCAA. In a lot of the cases, probably the great majority of them, you don't see aiding and abetting liability being kind of the statutory hook that the plaintiffs are trying to use. Instead, most of these cases, they're more like what I described in the Soto case, where you have some state law cause of action that you're pressing against the firearms industry. And the plaintiff is just trying to get over kind of the federalized standard for proximate causation. And so, you know, when this case was granted, people who, you know, follow this type of litigation all thought, oh, this is going to be a really big deal because the court's going to give us clarity on proximate causation. And, you know, that's going to have implications for just a ton of these cases. Based on the oral argument, I think it's actually maybe more likely that the court ultimately will end up deciding the case on aiding and abetting grounds and not ultimately reach the proximate causation issue. And it's, you know, I say that based, you know, on some of the questions that you're referring to there. You know, it's was not so clear that there was a, you know, clear majority for a particular approach to how courts ought to think about aiding and abetting liability in this context. The basic fault lines on this issue in terms of, you know, what's the legal standard that ought to be used. You know, the plaintiffs in this case and similar cases, they tend to press for a theory of proximate causation that just says, well, as long as the defendant's conduct is a substantial factor in bringing about whatever harm we've alleged, that's enough. And it doesn't really matter how many links there are in the chain of causation, or if, you know, there are intervening third parties that have committed crimes. If you are a substantial contributor to whatever happened that we are saying, was the injury to us, then that satisfies proximate causation. On the other hand, Smith and Wesson, the defendants in this case and similar cases say, no, you've got to have a direct connection between the alleged misconduct on the part of the defendant and the injury. And if the injury is mediated through, you know, a bunch of other things that third parties did, particularly if, you know, crimes committed by third parties, that will, absent, you know, very unusual circumstances, break the causal chain. And so there's no proximate causation. And that this is just a hugely important issue for the firearms industry going forward. I don't know that we're going to get clarity on that issue from the Supreme Court in this case, but those are kind of the two warring camps over this issue. One concept that came up repeatedly during the oral argument that I thought was interesting on the issue of proximate causation was this concept that you see in some proximate causation case law about you know, try to think about what is the injury or the harm that the underlying substantive law is trying to prevent. And then you ask, is the plaintiff alleging that they suffered an injury that falls within the scope of that type of injury? And if so, then that's sort of a reason to think that proximate causation ought to be satisfied. And there seem to be several of the justices that were kind of engaging with that as a framework for thinking about proximate causation. But like I say, I my best guess after listening to the argument yesterday is that we're just not going to get clarity about that or any of these other sort of proximate causation concepts in this case. It'll have to wait for another one.
Very helpful. Thank you. We have a question relating to the foreseeability concept that was raised in oral argument. Can you give a brief discussion of what that was and how it fits into either the aiding and abetting or proximate cause argumentation? And how persuasive was the line of reasoning, I think, put forward by the respondents on the foreseeability?
Yeah, I, you know, personally don't find the respondents' argument on foreseeability all that persuasive. I thought Noel Francisco had the right answer on this when it came up, which was to say foreseeability for purposes of proximate causation, it's necessary, but it's not sufficient. You know, if you do something and then there's a series of events that occur and somebody suffers an injury that was not foreseeable, well, okay, there's not going to be proximate causation there. But, you know, the facts of this case are, I think, a pretty good illustration of why foreseeability by itself should be insufficient, which is, you know, if you're a big distributor of, you know, manufacturer of firearms or alcohol or automobiles or kitchen knives, I mean, it doesn't matter. Just think about any product that is sold in commerce that, you know, can be misused and cause an injury. It may be 100% foreseeable that some, you know, small percentage of your products are going to be misused by third parties in a way that causes really, you know, serious harm. But that, you know, has traditionally not been thought of as enough to satisfy, you know, the proximate causation standard.
Got it. We have an audience question that I'll read out pretty much word for word, and hopefully you can help me understand what's being asked. Part of the conversation was about what kinds of statutes are applicable to the sale of marketing and firearms under the PLCAA exception. How did that relate to oral argument? I know it was raised a little bit. And did we get an answer as to whether or not that affects the outcome of this case?
Yeah, I think what the questioner is asking about, there's a line of precedent, you know, in the lower courts, particularly, there's a case out of the Second Circuit and a case out of the Ninth Circuit that deal with, okay, you know, we've got this statute that says that laws that are applicable to the gun industry, you know, you got to have a violation of one of those in order for there to be, you know, a lawsuit like this to go forward. And well, what exactly does the statute mean when it talks about laws that are applicable to the firearms industry, you know? And this is a sort of a difficult, I would say, a difficult issue, one that the lower courts have and are struggling to answer. The text of the statute is maybe not as clearly drafted on this point as it could be. I don't really see that issue, you know, meaningfully surfacing in the Supreme Court's opinion in this case. And the reason I say that is basically, as I understand it, at least the theory of liability that Mexico is putting forward is, you know, there are these illegal, you know, straw purchaser sales that, you know, they're just clearly violate federal gun laws. And, you know, there's aiding and abetting liability for these defendants in connection with those violation of the federal firearms laws. So I don't really see, I'm not sure that there's a you know, room for a big debate around whether those kinds of like gun specific statutes regulate the firearms industry. Where this issue gets hard is when you're talking about, like in the Soto case, you know, where it was not anything that was like firearm specific. It's just like the general state statute that prohibits, you know, deception and unfair practices directed towards consumers. And is that, you know, do you need something that's more gun specific than that in order to kind of trigger the potential application of this federal statute.
Got it. Thank you so much. Another question would relate to sort of the precedents that were raised. We had a lot of conversation on Twitter. I don't know the full case name, and a lot of conversation on direct sales. And one of the points of disagreement was whether or not those two created a dichotomy, that this could either be a direct sales case, or it could be a Twitter case, or that you could have it be fit under both precedents, given what it the aspects of the case and what it satisfies. Can you give a little bit of background on the sort of those precedents, what they mean, and then that conversation of, is this an either or can they work in harmony?
Yeah. So Twitter, this was a case that was the Supreme Court decided just maybe 2 or 3 years ago. It's its most recent aiding and abetting liability case. And basically in that case, what had happened is the plaintiffs were suing Twitter for basically facilitating communications by ISIS that, led to a kind of some terrorist attack. And the theory of it was that Twitter was basically helping, these terrorists commit their crimes by providing them with a mechanism for finding one another and communicating. And the Supreme Court said, that's not enough, to the extent that the only thing that Twitter has really done is just sort of set up a platform on which both good people and bad people can communicate with each other. That does not establish aiding and abetting liability. Direct sales is a much older case. I think it goes back to the 1940s. The defendant there was held to have satisfied the aiding and abetting standard, but had in a much more kind of active way consciously participated in the crime. And so I do think it's probably the most sort of useful way to think about it is there's sort of a spectrum in terms of there's a range of things that a seller of a product or service can do that, facilitate or make it possible for somebody to commit a crime. And depending on where you are on that spectrum, that kind of determines whether there's aiding and abetting liability or not. A lot of the questioning that, on this issue that I would say was kind of most promising for the defendants in the case sort of intimated that, the Mexico complaint really doesn't get into a lot of specifics about, here's a particular gun dealer that, you knew, and this is how you knew that they were, selling these things to the cartels, and, you did something beyond just kind of follow your ordinary sales practices to, facilitate that. There's nothing like that in the complaint. You could end up with an opinion in this case that really is that narrow, that just says, well, on these facts alleged, there's just not enough, see Twitter, and that could dispose of this case, without resolving some of these broader issues that we've been talking about.
Got it. We have two audience questions going back to the sort of international aspect of this. The first asks whether the fact that this case involves a foreign government does the fact that this case involves a foreign government mean that there was discussion of comity? And the second question relates to whether the fact that this is a foreign government talking about subjects in its own borders affect the attenuatedness or lack thereof of sort of that chain of events? And how did that affect oral argument?
Yeah, let me take those in reverse order. As to the second of those questions, I think the answer is clearly yes, that, the fact that, part of what's going on in this sort of very attenuated chain of causation that is being alleged is, smuggling guns illegally across an international border and then using them to commit crimes that in turn a foreign government, has to deal with. I mean, that very much does, further attenuate the causal chain. And, in some ways, looking at this case, one thing, if you're, rooting for the firearms industry in the case, one thing to worry about is the case overdetermined? This feels like it ought to be a pretty easy case to decide on proximate causation grounds, given the overlay of, you know, you've got this foreign government. And so, you know, to the extent that the court reaches those proximate causation issues, query whether it decides the case in a way that doesn't provide a ton of guidance in, you know, what is, you know, frankly, the more typical type of lawsuit that the industry faces, which is one that's brought either by, you know, people who've been injured in some shooting, or, you know, maybe a local government or a state government, as opposed to, you know, an international government or a foreign government. In terms of comedy, you know, it was interesting. As a concept, didn't surface a ton during the oral argument. The one time that it did, my old boss, Justice Alito, at one point asked the lawyer from Mexico, well, you know, does this theory of proximate causation, does it work both ways? I mean, you know, there are people who think the Mexican government maybe isn't doing as much as it should on in various respects, you know, on various issues. And, you know, is Mexico going to, you know, sort of lay down its foreign sovereign immunity and agree to accept kind of the similar theories of proximate causation and be held liable in U.S. courts? And, you know, so it's almost an anti-comedy, you know, the idea that here comes this international government that's, you know, pressing a theory, a legal theory that it itself wouldn't agree to be, you know, exposed to in a U.S. court. And of course, the lawyer for Mexico, for understandable reasons, wasn't willing to forego her client's foreign sovereign immunity or any of the rest of it. But it is, I think there's a kind of a good for the goose, good for the gander thing going on here, where, you know, in almost any other context, we wouldn't think that proximate causation would be satisfied on a theory like this. So, you know, why is this being taken seriously in a lawsuit against the gun industry?
Speaking of the questioning of particular justices, I had a question about Justice Thomas. Towards the end of oral argument, he made an interesting observation concerning the potential implication of the aiding and abetting framework on the due process rights of parties that are not party to the case. If you are saying, hey, you're aiding and abetting a crime, of people who haven't been tried or convicted for said crime. And there wasn't much discussion on it, but first off, does that affect other cases, or is that sort of unique to the nature of cases brought under the PLCAA? And how might that affect a broader conversation on this case?
Yeah, that was a super interesting observation. I'm not sure that there was a lot of discussion of that in the brief, but yeah, I mean, I think it's a fair point, and potentially one that sort of cuts across not just, you know, cases involving the PLCAA, where, you know, where the firearms industry, where aiding and abetting comes up, but just more generally. And you know, that does go to, I think, a useful broader point. This is something that Justice Kavanaugh referenced briefly in one of his questions. And actually, the day or two before the oral argument, Bill Barr had an editorial in the Wall Street Journal that raised this issue, which is, okay, if we take seriously, you know, this theory of aiding and abetting liability and proximate causation that the government of Mexico is pressing, you know, it's not just the gun industry that's potentially going to be on the hook for a kind of a new wave of tort liability. You know, anytime somebody sells, you know, an automobile, or, you know, really any consumer good that conceivably could be misused, and that, you know, if I sell a million automobiles, some number of them are going to get misused by drunk drivers or whatever, you know, suddenly, you know, American industry more generally is potentially on the hook for kind of a new type of tort liability that really doesn't have any foundation in American law.
Got it. Last couple of sort of general questions on oral argument before potentially moving into the ramifications of this case as we look forward. I'll ask it as a conjoined question. Were there any arguments you were surprised to see show up in oral argument? And conversely, anything that was sort of lacking that you were surprised not to see show up?
Yeah, you know, I would say to me the biggest surprise, maybe two. There were two surprises. One is the degree to which Justice Jackson seemed to have real sympathy for the defendants in the case. You know, we've talked a little bit about her line of questioning already, but I thought she had some very interesting and surprising, you know, points that she made. The other thing I'd say that was a bit of a surprise to me, you know, when the court granted cert in this case, I thought we're finally going to get clarity about the standard for proximate causation under the PLCAA. And that's still, you know, very much a possibility, but it did surprise me a bit that the aiding and abetting issue got as much airtime as it did. You know, it was really very much presented as, you know, a second banana, you know, as QP2 in the petition. But that seemed to be the issue that the justices sort of grabbed onto most attentively, which was a bit of a surprise.
Got it. Well, moving then to the potential ramifications of this case, and you've discussed some of this already, so I'll try to pull on those threads. Assuming the court in the hypothetical rules in favor of Mexico, first, what would that look like? And second, what doors would that open for other kinds of litigation?
Yeah. You know, this is not the result that I am expecting coming out of the oral argument, but I think the bar editorial was exactly right that it's very hard. You know, if you think that this type of lawsuit works, it's very hard to see what the limiting principle is. And so I think, you know, potentially this is going to be, you know, to the extent that Mexico wins here, this is going to be a great day for the plaintiffs bar, because it's not just the firearms industry that's potentially, you know, steering at a new type of tort liability.
Got it. Well, then I'll ask the reverse question. Assuming the alternate hypothetical, what are the implications of the case if the court sides with the gun manufacturers / the wholesale distributor? And what does the various kinds of sort of reasoning mean for potential other cases in the tort space?
Yeah, so this, you know, to the extent that the case goes for the defendants, it could end up being really, really important or potentially not that important at all. You know, one, if the court decides the case on aiding and abetting grounds, you know, that certainly will get these defendants out of this lawsuit, and maybe we'll get a little more clarity about the legal standard for aiding and abetting liability. Although even there, I'm not sure how much additional clarity we'll really get. You know, I think if you just sort of in a straightforward way apply what the Supreme Court did a couple of terms ago in the Twitter case to the facts alleged here, you could imagine an extremely narrow opinion. Maybe it's 8-1 or 9-0 that just says, you know, on these particular facts alleged, there's not aiding and abetting liability here. So you could get an opinion that really is that narrow and that doesn't do a ton for the gun industry or, you know, American business more generally, that as it's trying to defend itself against tort lawsuits. On the other hand, you know, it's also possible, and, you know, I'm often wrong when I try to predict what the court's going to do after an oral argument. It's also possible we could get an opinion that, you know, sides pretty strongly with what the defendants were saying about the proximate causation standard, that basically takes some of these RICO proximate causation cases and says that's really the right way for thinking about proximate causation and these PLCAA cases. And oh, by the way, you know, in the great majority of situations when you have a third party that's, you know, committing a crime with a product, and that's going to be an intervening event that breaks the causal chain, you know, and if we got an opinion like that, you know, I don't know about more generally the implications for tort litigation, but certainly this, you know, wave of lawsuits that the gun industry is facing today, you know, those, most of those cases would have to be dismissed.
Got it. Well, we've touched on this a little bit in the conversation on congressional intent and international sovereignty, but was there anything else in the questioning put forward that is worth flagging as we're thinking about the sort of disposition of this court or of particular justices to broader conversations on the role of the courts, Congress, international sovereignty, et cetera?
Yeah, I mean, I think, I guess I'd go back to some of the points that Justice Jackson made, you know, that this statute in particular seems, you know, an important part of its purpose is to shut down judicial policymaking when it comes to guns. And, you know, it was interesting to see, you know, her in particular grab hold of that point. And, you know, almost irrespective of whether the case ends up going off on aiding and abetting or proximate causation grounds, I guess one thing to look for in the opinion is to what extent will the court's ultimate opinion, you know, speak to that as an issue and say, hey, you know, we're not going to let a foreign government come into U.S. courts and, you know, get a federal judge to adopt, you know, kind of a whole programmatic set of gun policies that no legislature has enacted. You know, that's just not how we make it. That's not how we make our laws in this country. So, you know, we'll see if that's what the court ultimately says, but certainly seems more plausible now than it did before the oral argument yesterday.
Sounds good. Well, barring any additional audience questions, I may pose a last one and then we can get out of here a couple minutes early and give people back a section of their mornings. I know you've mentioned sort of the potential outcomes, but do you have a potential read, even like a general one, of how the court will rule or what the key or determinative points at issue will be? So even if you don't know how it's going to break out, like this will be the thing on which the opinion probably hangs.
Yeah, I mean, my best guess based on the oral argument is that we're probably going to see a relatively narrow opinion that just focuses on aiding and abetting liability. You know, there seemed to be, at least from the oral argument, it seemed like there was a kind of a fairly broad consensus on the court that, you know, what was alleged against these defendants was not enough for purposes of establishing aiding and abetting liability. And I think, you know, there's a good chance we'll end up with an opinion that really is that narrow. And, you know, at some level, it's a shame. It's a kind of a missed opportunity for the Supreme Court because, you know, the First Circuit's opinion in this case, it did, you know, sort of go out on a limb on issues of proximate causation in a way that, you know, plaintiffs in other cases, other circuits will definitely, you know, glom onto to the extent that they can. And there's, you know, a real meaningful division of authority on this issue. If you go back to the 90s, there was a case, the City of Philadelphia case from the Third Circuit, decided by a Third Circuit panel that included then Judge Alito, you know, that looked at, you know, a very similar set of factual allegations and came out the other way, saying that, that there was not, you know, sufficient allegations of proximate causation. And so this is going to be, I think, a hot area of litigation. It's going to be an area of litigation that, you know, people are debating for years to come, and unless and until the Supreme Court kind of weighs in on just what is the standard for proximate causation under the PLCAA.
Got it. We did get a last audience question, so I'll pose that and then we can wrap up. Is there a constitutional impediment for standing to a foreign government? And how did Mexico have standing to sue in the first place?
Yeah, I can't claim to be an expert on Article 3 standing of foreign sovereign governments, but I presume that they've, you know, it's the same type of analysis that you'd run through with, you know, a municipal government that brought a similar, you know, claim, which is, okay, they've sustained injury in fact because they've incurred costs associated with, you know, treating people who've been harmed or trying to prevent gun violence. And, you know, it's caused allegedly caused by what the defendants did. And the remedy is money and a bunch of gun control imposed by a federal judge, you know, would be the argument. I mean, it is a fair point to the extent that we're, you know, debating causation in the case, you know, to what extent should that kind of similar causation debate be baked into, you know, one of the steps in the Article 3 analysis of, you know, is it, have you really established causation for purposes of Article 3? And, you know, I'm not sure if that's a defense that the defendants raised in the case. I would think that the legal analysis there would track, and at least in certain respects, the proximate causation analysis that they had teed up for the Supreme Court. But it's a it's an interesting point that potentially some of those same points could have been made at the standing threshold in addition to being raised as a defense to liability.
Well, with that, we can wrap. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you spending your time this morning and sharing your valuable expertise and insight, breaking down this case and oral argument. Thanks also to our audience for joining and participating. Welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about other upcoming virtual events. With that, we can wrap slightly early, give everybody back a section of their days, and we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.